Do you want something to drink?
Water if there is some.
So I'll introduce you guys and then you speak and Fran will speak. Can you hear me? It's a good thing we have a technological wizard here, which I'm not. Good morning. This is a great turnout. I'm really pleased to see so many people. I'm Dina Hurwitz. I know some of you. I teach the Human Rights Clinic here and direct the Human Rights Program. And I wanted to say on behalf of both the Human Rights Program and the Law and Business Program, welcome to this panel on corporate liability in U.S. courts for global actions. This is the first time that we've co-sponsored something with the Law and Business Program, so I'm very pleased and I hope it's the beginning of some good, fruitful work together. So this conversation about corporate liability really, it escalated, let's say, after the Supreme Court's decision in Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum last spring, but obviously it's been going on for a lot longer time and it's a bigger question. And I just wanted to lay a little bit of groundwork about the question of state responsibility and due diligence to frame the discussion. The state's duty to protect against human rights abuses by third parties is the basis of the due diligence principle, and this includes business, we would say. There's a corporate responsibility to respect human rights, and there's a need for more effective access to remedies. And it's always a question of what the state is doing and whether the state should be playing a role. But when it comes to a state's extraterritorial obligations, the issue requires some further consideration. The fundamental question being, of course, whether a due diligence obligation can be said to extend to home states, the states of incorporation or of primary control of a company, and to regulate the activities of this company when it invests or acts abroad. So, there's the question about whether a home state's failure to regulate a company's activities abroad results in a breach of its state due diligence obligation and therefore engages in some kind of international responsibility or raises the issue of international responsibility. So this is the basis for this discussion. We have one wonderful speaker who's Marco Simons, who's going to address the civil law issues, and Brandon Garrett, who will address the criminal law issues. I just want to say that about Marco, he's the legal director from Earth Rights International, and besides being founded by three UVA law graduates, Earth Rights was the first to successfully bring an alien tort statute lawsuit against a corporation in Doe v. Unocal, that is for violations of the law of nations. The alien tort statute, of course, is a civil statute that was first promulgated under the First Judiciary Act of 1789. And it grants jurisdiction to U.S. courts to hear claims against, brought by aliens for acts, torts committed in breach of the law of nations or a treaty of the United States. So I won't say very much about Kiobel, I think Marco will, and I think it's really interesting to to think about the history that Earth Rights has in this whole picture, having started that that suit in the 90s, 1995, I think. WUNICAL, that is. I don't think Brandon Garrett needs too much of an introduction, being on our faculty, but I will mention to start with that he has a new book coming out called Too Big to Jail, How Prosecutors Take on Corporations. And he'll be talking about broader issues like bribery and corruption, but also I think bigger issues of investment. It's interesting that that Earth Rights, I think, might have been one of the first to coin the slogan, too big to fail. So now we have too big to fail, too big to jail. So without further ado, let's start with you, Marco. Thank you.
Thank you, Dina. Dina didn't mention also that we go back a long way, and when I was a law student at Yale, Dina was a clinical fellow. So it's always great to be invited here and to work with Dina, and we've worked with the clinic on a number of occasions as well. I'll say a few more words about Earth Rights International. As Dina mentioned, it has a long time connection with UVA Law School, and in addition to being founded by UVA law grads back in 1995, one of whom, Katie Redford, is in the women's wall over there. We also have a couple of other UVA lawyers working for us and regularly have UVA law students as interns, one of whom is over there. Hi, Rachel. So we focus on assisting communities in asserting their rights in cases of environmental and human rights abuse around the world. And that especially comes up in the context of corporate accountability, frequently involving extractive industries and also mega projects such as dams and highways that affect indigenous communities, minority groups, other peoples who are generally not within the power structures of the regions where they live. And as Dina mentioned, we got our start, or the first lawsuit we filed was a case called Doe versus UNICAL. And the situation that we were addressing there was a natural gas pipeline being built in southern Burma, which is now known as Myanmar. And at the time, Burma was under a rather brutal military dictatorship, and the Burmese army was notorious for human rights violations. And in order to build the pipeline, the Western oil companies who were spearheading this project used the Burmese military not only for security services, but also for some ancillary services such as building roads and helipads in service of the project, and in the process conscripted a number of local villagers for forced labor, and in some cases tortured, killed, and raped innocent civilians in the process of providing security services for this pipeline project. And so on behalf of about a dozen of the victims of this project, we've brought suit in California against UNICAL, which is an American oil company at the time, which has since been acquired by Chevron, and litigated that case for about 9 years until it ultimately settled in 1995. As Dina mentioned, it was the first case brought under the Alien Tort Statute that was allowed to proceed against a corporation, where the court said that this case could advance, the first case to get past the motion to dismiss stage. Not all of the claims in that case were brought under the Alien Tort Statute. The Alien Tort Statute, as Dina said, allows claims for violations of international law in federal court, but we also brought ordinary tort claims like negligence and battery and even infliction of emotional distress. So we litigated both under these common law tort headings and under the international law headings of crimes against humanity and torture and forced labor. So the Unocal case, you know, was a landmark case that helped to establish the principle that corporations, when they operate around the world, need to respect the human rights of the people that they encounter, and also that they need to be careful about being complicit with security forces or others who might violate human rights on their behalf. So fast forward to this year, and we get the Kiobel decision from the Supreme Court. The Kiobel case arose out of similar circumstances, this time in Nigeria, where Royal Dutch Petroleum, which is Shell Oil, was operating in a very conflict-ridden environment in the Niger Delta and faced extreme local opposition from the Ogoni people, and partnered with the Nigerian military to brutally suppress an Ogoni movement to assert their own rights. Again, some of the victims of this brutality brought suit in New York under the Alien Tort Statute. And the Kiobel case had an odd odyssey up to the Supreme Court. First, it went up to the Second Circuit on an interlocutory appeal, and even though the questions presented in the interlocutory appeal and the decision, the district court decision that they were appealing from, didn't have anything to do with corporate liability, the Second Circuit issued a somewhat stunning decision in the Kiobel case, ruling that there is no jurisdiction under the Alien Tort Statute for suits against corporations because international law simply did not apply to corporations. This decision was widely criticized and was soon rejected by three other federal courts of appeals. And the Kiobel case then went up to the Supreme Court. And there were oral arguments around this question of corporate liability. And then an even stranger thing happened, which is that the Supreme Court ordered re-argument on the question of whether the Alien Tort Statute applies to injuries in the territory of a foreign sovereign. And this had been an unquestioned principle in pretty much almost every alien tort case since the Falardiga decision, which was the 1980 decision by the Second Circuit, which heralded the modern usage of the Alien Tort Statute, which is an 18th century law, for human rights offenses. And the Falardiga case involved a Paraguayan family who brought suit against a Paraguayan police captain who had tortured their son to death in Paraguay and had happened to be found living in Brooklyn after those events. And since Falardiga, it had been an unquestioned article of faith for pretty much every court that considered this, that you could bring these suits in the United States without regard to where the conduct occurred. And so suddenly the Supreme Court changed the conversation and changed the question and said, we want to examine whether you can really use this statute to bring claims for injuries arising abroad. And when they made their decision this spring, it surprised a lot of people, but also confused a lot of people and is still confusing a lot of people. And so I would like to tell you what it means, but it's way too soon to do that. But the Supreme Court issued a long majority opinion going into all kinds of talk about the presumption against extraterritoriality and the history of the Alien Tort Statute and all of this language. And then in a very, very brief conclusion at the end, basically said, well, some cases arising outside the U.S. might be able to be brought under the Alien Tort Statute. But in this case, the only connection to the United States is that it's a multinational corporation that does business here, and that's not enough. So despite all this language in the opinion, the actual holding of it seems to be that a multinational corporation whose only connection to the U.S. is its mere presence here cannot be sued for abuses arising outside the United States. The lower courts have had quite a headache interpreting this and figuring out what exactly the Supreme Court meant, and there have been more than half a dozen decisions so far. A couple of courts, including the Second Circuit, have taken the view that it's a very strict presumption against extraterritoriality, and unless there is substantial conduct within the United States, that there cannot be a suit under the Alien Tort Statute. There are a variety of cases that have been allowed to proceed since then under various rationales. So, for example, there is a case involving the embassy bombing in Kenya, and the court there determined that this was an attack on the United States and was sufficiently related to U.S. interests that the lawsuit arising out of that attack could proceed in U.S. courts. There's another case involving a U.S. citizen who has been very active in persecuting sexual minorities in Uganda. And the court there found that because the defendant was a U.S. citizen and because some of his actions took place in the United States, that was enough for the case to proceed after Kyovo. There is another case where the court found that the defendant, even though none of the actions occurred in the United States and the defendant was not a U.S. citizen, he was a lawful permanent resident here, and that was enough for the case to proceed. On the other hand, there was another case arising out of torture at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq against a U.S. defense contractor who allegedly participated in the torture, where, you know, there were U.S. personnel involved in a zone controlled by the United States and, you know, within the U.S. military chain of command, and the suit was against a U.S. corporation, and the court there said that wasn't enough. So I would like to tell you what it means, but for the moment, we don't really know. There are a number, I count at least six cases pending before different courts of appeals at the moment that'll tell us more. So aside from the Alien Tort Statute, where does that leave us? I mentioned that in the Doe v. Unocal case, in addition to the Alien Tort Statute claims, there are also common law tort claims. And there's no barrier to bringing those now. In fact, we continue to litigate transnational or international cases under common law tort theories, and we intend to keep doing so. There's no, you know, people have sometimes looked at the Alien Tort Statute and said, oh, this allows claims to be brought from anywhere in the world into U.S. courts. And that was never a unique feature of the Alien Tort Statute. That has always been the case under U.S. law. It goes back to principles of English law. It was confirmed by the Supreme Court in the 19th century that, you know, generally tort claims are transitory. They follow the tortfeasor wherever they are. If you can get personal jurisdiction over the defendant, you can sue them here for anything they've done anywhere in the world. That's just the basic transitory tort principle. And so suing someone here for an abuse that occurred in Burma or Nigeria is not at all unusual, and we don't need the Alien Tort Statute to do it. So we can continue bringing these cases under ordinary common law theories. The fact that we can do that may underscore the short-sightedness of the Supreme Court's opinion, because the effect of the Kyovo decision may be to push some of these cases out of federal court and into state court, which is not necessarily the best result for complex international cases that could raise potentially difficult foreign policy questions. But there are a lot of other frontiers in the campaign to hold corporations accountable to their victims for international abuses. And in recent years, our organization has gotten involved, and a lot of other people have gotten involved in other actions around the world. So this is both transnational actions in other countries. So for example, there's been increased activity in Canada, in the UK, and in the EU against their corporations for injuries that they are accused of arising in other countries. In the United States, one of the big hurdles to hearing these cases in U.S. courts is often the doctrine of forum non conveniens. The EU, in that respect, although not in many other respects, is a more favorable place to litigate because under the Brussels regulation, the EU has basically eliminated the doctrine of forum non conveniens for all EU countries with respect to EU corporations. That means is you cannot dismiss a case against an EU corporation, you know, a corporation headquartered in the EU, no matter where the lawsuit arises, it's not a defense to say that it's more appropriately litigated somewhere else. That continues to be a barrier in the United States, of course. There are also a number of lawsuits that have been started in the countries where these abuses occur. Now, that's often quite challenging, especially if it is in a zone of conflict or something. But for example, in Nigeria, there are domestic lawsuits now against the oil companies that have been proceeding in the courts there. And one of the ways the U.S. courts have gotten involved, or we have tried to involve the U.S. courts in these sorts of actions, is that there is a federal statute, which you probably won't learn about in law school, and I know I didn't, called 28 U.S.C. 1782, catchy title, which allows discovery under the federal rules in U.S. courts in connection with lawsuits pending abroad, which is potentially a very powerful tool to assist litigation in other countries because the U.S. discovery process is one of the most liberal in the world and can be quite helpful to foreign litigants. So for example, there's a Nigerian case pending against Chevron Nigeria, their subsidiary there, challenging the practice of gas flaring, the burning off of the associated gas in the oil fields of Nigeria. And so we've brought a discovery petition under this statute against the Chevron parent corporation to try to get some information to assist in that lawsuit, because doing it through the Nigerian procedures is quite difficult, if not impossible. Another new frontier is that there may actually be new legislation coming or new uses of old legislation. And at the federal level, nobody expects anything to happen anytime soon. But there are 50 states, and some of them have legislatures who will pass almost any old thing. And some of them have passed laws in the past. For example, the Alien Tort Statute itself was based on a previous statute passed by the state of Connecticut, which allowed suits in Connecticut courts for violations of international law. That law is still on the books. And so what you're likely to see in the coming years is new legislation in the states to allow state law remedies for violations of international law, as well as new uses of existing laws that have been dusted off. And eventually, who knows, this might spur the federal government to act if Congress doesn't like the fact that the states are getting involved. Finally, there could be ultimately some action at the international level. A few years ago, the United Nations Human Rights Council approved the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, which is the most comprehensive UN document on the human rights obligations of multinational corporations, which came out of a six-year mandate by a special representative of the Secretary General. And just recently, the government of Ecuador, along with a number of other countries at the UN, filed a petition with the Human Rights Council calling for a binding accountability framework to follow on the guiding principles. So the guiding principles are a set of, essentially, a set of recommended norms for corporations to follow and for countries to implement, but they don't have any legal weight. They don't have any legal teeth to them. They have whatever binding effect countries choose to give them in implementing them in their national frameworks. But what Ecuador has recently called for is an international framework for some sort of binding accountability regime. That's probably a number of years off, but at some point we could actually see an international framework to hold corporations accountable for grave abuses of human rights. So I hope that despite the Kiobel opinion, that the trend is actually toward one of greater accountability for violations of human rights. And I tend to think that it is, that when we filed Doe v. Unocal, corporations simply didn't expect that if they operated in a place like Burma or in the Niger Delta or, you know, in the farthest corners of the Amazon, that they could be held to account in any court for their actions. Now, virtually no corporation, in my opinion, would conclude that anywhere in the world is completely beyond the reach of legal accountability. And that, at least, is a step forward.
Hello, I'm going to stand up a little bit. So I'm going to talk about something different but related to what Marco just told you about. I'm not going to talk about human rights, but rather criminal accountability in the United States for acts abroad. And these are not prosecutions for human rights abuses, but they involve the issue of corporate compliance and the types of due diligence requirements that Dina Hurwitz began by describing, and which we might talk a little bit more about afterwards. And some of the cases look like some of the cases which could be framed as human rights cases brought by victims, but instead these are cases brought more directly concerning environmental violations in the U.S. or also mega projects abroad, where the case is about bribery concerning the project, or business practices like fraud or antitrust. But there's, even though, you know, a securities fraud, a white collar case might seem pretty far removed from human rights, the same kind of accounting that you want in place to prevent fraud or foreign bribery might be the same kind of compliance that would prevent money laundering to terrorist groups, or corruption that also involves payments to groups involved in human rights abuses. So there may be some connections just in terms of the type of compliance you do to prevent white-collar violations and maybe similarly human rights violations. So what I wanted to talk about was a case just to illustrate how U.S. prosecutors go about prosecuting companies and foreign companies in particular. So I have a little video clip and some slides that I'll show you. I'll try to not to show too many of them in detail, but let's see. Here we go. So I have a book, but you can't get it. I'm still working on it. Maybe next year. The guy I'd like to talk to you about is the banker who worked at a German multinational company called Siemens, which is involved in all sorts of projects ranging from the types of mega projects that Marco described to making, you know, coffee makers, household appliances. He wasn't really a banker. He was a illicit banker. So here's my little video clip. Oh, wait a minute. It doesn't want to play my video clip. Maybe if I do this, it'll play the video clip. But here we go.
In nearly all business units of Siemens. Paying bribes was customary in nearly all business units of Siemens.
Reinhard Sikacek was in charge of part of Siemens' massive billion-dollar international bribery operations.
I was a true Siemens man, for sure. I was known as the keeper of the slush funds. We all knew what we were doing was illegal.
To avoid getting caught, Siemens used secret bank accounts in places like Switzerland, and front companies, plus the age-old method, cash.
For €1 million, you don't need a big suitcase because the bills aren't very big. A briefcase is enough. €200,000 isn't so much that you couldn't carry it in your coat pocket.
So very helpful advice. Here are those quotes. He later talked about how he never thought that he would get into trouble because this was part of established business practice at Siemens. He never thought he would go to jail or get in any particular trouble. This was just his job to keep the slush fund and make sure that money made its way through these bank accounts or through suitcases of cash to different consultants that Siemens hired around the world to help get government contracts for really big deals. And when you, he finally did go to jail, although he cooperated and got a kind of a light sentence. Hear more about the banker in a minute. In the United States, unlike to some degree in Germany, although the EU is moving towards more forms of corporate liability, and some countries have a version of it, in the US there absolutely is corporate criminal liability, in federal courts at least. There had always been some discomfort with the concept, and this is everyone's favorite quote in the area of corporate criminal liability. Can you really hold a corporation morally responsible? It's not really a moral agent in any way. It's an artificial legal entity. And the approach in the U.S. in federal courts, dating back to this Supreme Court case in 1909, is not really to hold the corporation morally accountable in any literal sense, but to impose a derivative liability on the company. Basically, a company under the doctrine of respondeat superior is liable for the criminal acts of its agents if they're done for the benefit of the company in the scope of their employment. So it's a very, very broad corporate criminal liability standard. And if there's anything that you all know, even not having taken federal criminal law with me about federal criminal law, it's probably that there are a lot of really broad federal crimes, which gives U.S. prosecutors a fair amount of power to go after companies should they so desire. This is just an example of how a judge would explain this standard for corporate criminal liability to a jury in one of the really rare cases where a company took its case to trial. And this is maybe the best known corporate criminal trial ever in the Arthur Andersen case in 2002. It was a partnership, not a corporation. They say, an entity is legally bound by the acts and statements its agents do or make within the scope of their employment. So listen, jury, if you find that, the employees or even a single employee at Andersen violated this criminal statute, then you could find the company liable. So, back to the Siemens case. Why did U.S. prosecutors get involved? It didn't start out as a U.S. investigation. It's hard to imagine exactly how U.S. investigators would have known about what was going on at Siemens. None of the bribes were about, bribing U.S. officials to try to get contracts in the United States. If that had happened, then you could see how U.S. officials might have gotten tipped off. Instead, it was banking regulators in the small Republic of Liechtenstein that noticed something funny. They noticed a lot of money moving around in some offshore accounts, and they traced it to Siemens. And then prosecutors in Munich in Germany sent out investigators. They went to the banker's front door and to other officials' front doors, and they arrested people, and they looked at books and records, and they started an investigation. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, the Securities and Exchange Commission in the U.S. gets involved, and federal prosecutors in the U.S. get involved. They say this is, and it still is, there's the biggest foreign bribery case brought in the U.S. ever. This is one of my favorite parts. For those of you who are interested in corporate practice at a big law firm, Debevoise and Plimpton, $800 million billed just in this one case. So it can be highly enjoyable and lucrative work. And they found out a lot, actually. And so the U.S. lawyers that Siemens hired to investigate itself uncovered quite a bit more bribe, more bribery deals than had been known about from the initial investigation in Liechtenstein and in Germany. And some of these were big projects. a national identity card system in Argentina, two major subway systems in Venezuela, a mobile phone system in Bangladesh, all sorts of other things. So, why was this case in the U.S.? The statute has lots of parts to it, and I'm not going to bore you with them, but there is a statute in the U.S. known as the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or the FCPA. And there are a few different ways that one can get jurisdiction extraterritorially under it. One of them is if the company is an issuer or lists stock in the U.S. And Siemens did so. They said, the statute talks about corrupt making of payments or gifts and the like to foreign officials to try to influence them. And there's a separate provision which also says that companies that have stock listed in the U.S. have to keep accurate accounting provisions. And this is more of a due diligence requirement. They have to maintain accurate books and records and also have sound internal accounting controls to make sure what is in those books and records is accurate. Now obviously your books and records aren't accurate if you're paying a lot of bribe money on the side, which isn't reflected. Now it could be that you would accurately report your bribes and have a bribery account, but then you'd be openly violating U.S. law, and that might not be advisable. And in fact, at Siemens, they weren't reporting the bribe money. They would have big cash drawers. There was a lot of cash floating around. So, even bigger picture, more and more companies, big companies, are being prosecuted, although the number of companies prosecuted in the U.S. has remained somewhat the same, actually, as far as we know over the past few decades. Not that many corporations or other organizations are prosecuted in federal court each year. We're talking about maybe 200 prosecutions a year. But the size of the fines in these cases has really changed, especially over the last decade or so. There was a big jump in 1999 when a few of the really big early international antitrust cases were brought all at once. Average fines have also gone up. One part of this trend, a significant part of this trend, is the size of cases brought against foreign corporations. Now obviously foreign, domestic, you could have a domestic company that's really multinational and does work all over the world. It's somewhat artificial. I'm looking at companies that are incorporated abroad, and many of them are highly connected to the U.S., companies like Siemens that may be based abroad, but they have stock listed in the United States. So this is a rough proxy. If you look at the 20 biggest corporate fines through 2012, and this doesn't include the now biggest one against BP, which is also a foreign corporation, coming out of the Gulf spill. That would go on top. It's a little bit bigger than the Pharmacy and Upjohn one. You can see there's Siemens. There's a number of really big antitrust cases against foreign companies. Some other foreign corrupt practices cases, some fraud cases, and a number of really big pharmaceutical cases. Quite a few cases against foreign companies here in this list of the biggest cases based on the fine. Almost all these cases settle. And so the Arthur Andersen case was really unusual in that a company took its case to a jury trial. And there are basically three paths to settlement. One path is the case is just not criminal at all. And regulators like the Securities and Exchange Commission bring a case, but they decide that ultimately there isn't enough evidence or justification to bring the case as a criminal case. A second path is the company is convicted and pleads guilty. And I'll talk about how that happens in a second. A third path is a sort of a quasi-criminal agreement called the Deferred Prosecution Agreement. Sometimes they're framed as non-prosecution agreements, which are slightly different. It's abbreviated here as a DPA. And increasingly, the really interesting companies, the big public companies, receive these more lenient agreements where they aren't convicted. Interestingly, though, foreign companies tend not to receive these as much. These are often the biggest companies that get these more lenient deals. More lenient, at least in the sense that there isn't a conviction, that the fines might be just as big, the other terms might be just as stringent. A lot of these cases are brought by the Department of Justice itself, as opposed to the other offices. So if you look at the different crimes, there's just a whole range of different crimes that these slightly more lenient agreements involve. Kickbacks, money laundering, some immigration offenses, a
lot of fraud, a lot of foreign corrupt practices cases, though, involving this foreign bribery stuff. This is how federal prosecutors are supposed to decide whether it's worth bringing charges against the company. Because obviously there are a lot of individuals prosecuted every year in federal court, including for white-collar offenses. And so there's a question, okay, if you prosecute the employees, is that enough? Is there a separate reason to hold the company accountable too? And so for some time there's been this memo listing factors that you want, that you're supposed to consider if you're a federal prosecutor to decide whether corporate accountability is worthwhile or not. The first few factors just have to do with, well, was there serious wrongdoing at the company? Is this a really bad crime? Were a lot of people at the company involved? Does the company have a prior history of being up to no good in this area? The next factors, though, relate to how the company behaved. Did it tell you about it? Now, obviously, Siemens did not report itself to U.S. prosecutors. The bribery was on a pervasive scale. But what we'll find out in a minute is that they did actually cooperate pretty extensively once they were reported. Did they have good compliance? Were they making a lot of efforts to stop this from happening? Were these, you know, a couple of sneaky rogue employees, or was there a larger problem with the company's culture in some way that explains why the crimes happened? And then what has the company done since to try to prevent this from happening again? So finally, prosecutors also consider, well, would there be other negative consequences to prosecuting the company? Would doing so harm a lot of innocent employees? Would they lose their jobs? Is it enough for civil regulators to do this without prosecutors being involved? These are the crimes that foreign companies were in particular prosecuted for. Lots of antitrust, a fair number of environmental cases, including a lot of cases involving dumping at sea, a lot of foreign bribery cases, and a bunch of other things too. Siemens pleaded guilty, as well as three subsidiaries in federal court. That's an interesting plea hearing, because during a plea hearing, normally the defendant is there personally and allocutes and explains that he agrees that he did something wrong. Obviously, a corporation can't do that, so it begins by saying, I'm a member of the managing board of Siemens and the general counsel, so he's the one who's going to basically accept the conviction on behalf of the corporation. The judge says, okay, you've been authorized to do this, and he says, yes. Do you understand the nature of the offense, or does the company understand the nature of the offense? Yes. So they're asking a lot of the same questions that you ask a regular criminal defendant. Some judges actually get upset if the CEO or someone really high up doesn't get sent in person to be there during the plea hearing. And so the judge does ask, you know, Siemens paid a fine that was far below what the sentencing guidelines might recommend. So the judge says, well, why is this fine so low? Prosecutor says, well, but they've done extraordinary things to cooperate. After all, they paid a New York law firm an awful lot of money to investigate, and so they've done a lot of things to hire new employees and to make sure this doesn't happen again. And so he talks about the extraordinary efforts to cooperate and share information that they've uncovered in their own investigation. I mean, obviously, you know, the small group of lawyers at the Department of Justice that does these foreign bribery cases cannot spend $800 million hiring accountants and lawyers around the globe to uncover this information. This investigation would only have been possible with the corporation doing it itself. So the judge says, okay, seems fair, and that was the end. The company was convicted. There was a fair amount to that conviction. There was a big fine. And it was interesting, about half the fine was a U.S. fine. They paid $800 million to German prosecutors and $800 million to U.S. prosecutors. So the U.S. role in this case in terms of a share of the fines ultimately was really significant. They also had to do a lot in the way of compliance and due diligence requirements. They would have to hire a corporate monitor who would be in place alongside a U.S. lawyer, a separate monitor, to basically oversee this whole process of trying to make sure that this bribery didn't happen again. They had to agree to cooperate, which meant cooperating should U.S. prosecutors decide to go after any employees. They would have to help gather evidence against their own current or former employees. And there are indictments against a bunch of Siemens employees. None of them are in the U.S., and it's not clear how we're going to be able to get them. And it says any breach, any new violation could result in a new prosecution, with all of the admissions of wrongdoing used against Siemens. The terms of, there isn't time to talk about all of this, but basically, that's what these agreements look like. the better ones, at least, have monitors. They require detailed compliance reforms. Then there are the ones that don't require that, and you wonder, what is the agreement for? But the Siemens case is an example of a quite detailed agreement where prosecutors have a sense of what they want the company to be doing, and they are actually forcing the company to hire people to oversee the whole process. There are other ways a company could be sentenced. If prosecutors had concluded that Siemens was basically through and through a criminal enterprise, they could have fined it to death. This provision is very, very rarely used. If a company doesn't have much in the way of assets, a lot of companies prosecuted aren't that big, then they can pay what they can. There has been a foreign company, though, actually fined to death for overseas corruption. In general, victims are supposed to be compensated. And then there are questions, you know, can you identify victims in a case? But certainly in environmental cases, if there are communities where people were ill, or you know, in the BP case, if there's an explosion or it looks like a torque or there are victims, victims are supposed to be compensated first before any fine is paid. And then there's this whole very messy framework for deciding how to punish an organization. And it raises really complicated issues about how do you think about punishing a corporation. And they look to, you know, basically how bad was the corporation? How do you tell? How involved was management? Did they violate prior orders? Did they obstruct justice? And then they mitigate, saying, actually, if a company has good compliance, if they reported themselves, if they cooperated, then we should cut them a break and maybe reduce their fine quite a bit. And so the guidelines for sentencing corporations are flexible, and they take into account characteristics of the whole organization. They don't look like the sentencing guidelines for individual defendants, where all you care about is sort of the base level of the offense and the person's criminal history, with very limited opportunity to change that. In general, the idea of sentencing corporations under the sentencing guidelines in the federal system is supposed to take into account this idea of corporate good citizenship, best practices. We want to encourage companies to detect crime themselves, to report crime themselves, and to do due diligence and have compliance so that they can prevent crime themselves in the future. I'll flip through a lot of this. So Siemens actually did do quite a bit above and beyond actually what they were required to do when they pleaded guilty. They cashiered almost all of their top leadership. There's their new CEO. Their old CEO wrote a very disgruntled memoir. But they actually replaced most of their top managers, over half. They created a gigantic new compliance department with more than 500 full-time staff. A lot of the things they did really were so above and beyond the call of duty. You know, I don't know of any U.S. corporations that have been prosecuted that did this much in response to a case like this. They brought in auditors from fancy accounting firm to develop a whole new anti-corruption toolkit. And interestingly, they're also trying to enter these agreements, and they have, with their competitors. And normally, like, sitting in the same room with competitors raises criminal liability concerns, right, antitrust concerns. But they say that, you know, we're talking with other industry players to make sure that we all follow anti-corruption norms, to make sure no one pays bribes. And, you know, the CEO has given big speeches about how their culture has changed. I had a long talk with their corporate monitor, who is a very prominent person, former finance minister in Germany, Dr. Theo Weigel. They actually kept him on longer because they thought he was so valuable. And you know, from the outside, no idea how effective this all was. The company certainly describes making enormous changes, which seemed like a long ways from the days of the banker, where it was just open practice to carry suitcases of money around the world to get big contracts from foreign governments. But to end with the banker again, who isn't happy about his experience, having been prosecuted in the end, he leaves us with the words that the 11th commandment is don't get caught. And obviously, we have no idea whether the efforts by U.S. prosecutors, who can't bring that many cases, they certainly can't bring as many cases as human rights groups and civil law firms like Marcos Firm can bring. They have limited resources. You know, who are they not catching? Does bringing a couple of really big cases like the Siemens case send a message to other companies that they better reform their practices? Hopefully it does. Obviously, industry literature talks all about these cases. White-collar firms, big firms talk all about how you had better comply, otherwise you'll end up like Siemens. But that's the open question, is what is the deterrent impact of taking these cases criminal? So thanks very much, and I'll stop talking and look forward to your questions.
We'll take questions and comments, but I want to give a chance for each of you to say a word if you want before we start.
Yeah, just a brief word of reaction. I think that the corporate prosecutions that you're talking about raise interesting questions about our national priorities, in the sense that Royal Dutch Shell was in exactly the same situation vis-a-vis the United States as Siemens, in the sense that both are listed on the New York Stock Exchange, both are foreign corporations with a large multinational presence with U.S. subsidiaries and such. But Siemens' only connection to the United States is that they do business here and are listed on the U.S. stock exchanges. And so while we have a law that allows criminal prosecution in the United States for extraterritorial bribery by a foreign multinational, if the same corporation engages in crimes against humanity, we let them off, essentially. That's basically what the Supreme Court held in the Kyogo case. There was a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Human Rights a few years back when Senator Durbin, the chair of that subcommittee, made this point and said that he thought that it was a bit incongruous that we criminally penalize extraterritorial bribery but not extraterritorial human rights abuses or environmental crimes. And then that, to some degree, that also extends into the restitution to victims. You mentioned that corporations are supposed to provide restitution to their victims, in these sorts of deals. One of the cases that we're litigating right now came partly out of a U.S. criminal prosecution, which is the Doe versus Chiquita case, where Chiquita, the banana company, for many years was paying millions of dollars to paramilitary death squads in Colombia. And the U.S. government, the Justice Department, prosecuted them for this because the paramilitary organization that they were funding was a designated foreign terrorist organization. And so this is a violation of U.S. criminal law. Chiquita paid a $25 million fine to the U.S. government. So far, the victims of the AUC's brutality, the paramilitary organization's death squads, have not received any remedies or restitution whatsoever. So there are some disconnects in how our government approaches both the kinds of offenses that we deem fit to punish, as well as the modes of punishment and remedies that we impose.
Thanks, Marco. We'll just open it up, okay? Comments? Questions for either?
Well, we can just talk now.
one response to one of the things that Marco said.
Can you pull the?
Sure. I certainly agree. There is a lot of unevenness to when federal prosecutors decide to try to compensate victims or not. And judges haven't taken a very active role in making sure that the guidelines are followed and victims get restitution when they're supposed to. On whether doing business here is enough under crimes like the FCPA versus in civil cases, well, for one thing, judges are always going to be much more deferential when it's a prosecutor bringing a case, because you can say, well, this is absolutely U.S. interest. It's the federal government prosecuting a crime. But another connection is that there are these accounting provisions, right? Bribery affects the financials of a company. And so if it's listed on the U.S. stock exchange, the idea is that investors need to know accurately about the company's finances. So what you need is a statute that says that companies need to report the effect on their bottom line of their support for human rights violations abroad. And as long as
long as it's part of mandatory reporting to the SEC and needs to be reflected in their financial statements, then all of a sudden you can develop a theory that doing business is absolutely intertwined with human rights.
We've got some proposed legislation.
Yeah.
Was definitely a level playing field concern. The FCPA wasn't enforced much against corporations for a few decades after it was passed. And actually, the original concerns that led to the enactment of the statute in 1977 were really totally different concerns. There were concerns, it was post-Watergate concern, that that there were foreign companies, among others, also domestic companies, that were giving money illicitly to the Nixon campaign. So, you know, absolutely about domestic politics and domestic bribery. But as that was investigated, it was uncovered that companies had slush funds generally that they were using around the world for all sorts of purposes. And a lot of companies basically self-reported and got amnesty in the investigations that surrounded the enactment of the law. But the law has been amended a number of times to broaden its extraterritorial reach. And increased comfort with bringing cases against foreign companies may also come from international treaties that were signed in the late 90s. It certainly could have created more tension for a case like the Siemens case to be brought before Germany had signed those treaties and when payment of bribes by German companies was absolutely illegal and permitted under German law. Once it became illegal in Germany too, there was far greater comfort among U.S. prosecutors of bringing the case, and that's been an interesting story in the FCPA as well. More countries have passed laws that mirror the U.S. law, or even toughen their laws because they would rather their own prosecutors bring the case than U.S. prosecutors get involved. And so the U.K. has passed a new bribery act, and it says it's going to be more aggressive about going after these cases now. The U.S. approach is sort of is being proselytized. But you absolutely did hear the concern from U.S. companies that this is going to kill us. If our competitors can all get away with paying bribes, they're going to win these contracts. And, you know, there's going to be, it's not going to help reduce corruption in the world. It's just going to hurt U.S. business. So that's a frequently expressed concern.
I want to jump in with a question myself. It seems to me that after Kiobel, international law itself seems to be a little bit of a casualty because the discussion here has been mostly about strengthening and using domestic law. And of course, the Alien Tort Statute talked about the law of nations or a U.S. treaty, right? So maybe both of you could address, in your case, Brandon, you just mentioned some reliance on some international treaties. So perhaps both of you could talk a little bit about what will come of, what's the effect of international law and the force and the implementation of international law in the future.
I can just briefly say, I don't teach international law. I have no business talking about this. But in the areas where you see U.S. prosecutors bringing more prosecutions against foreign companies, they have to rely on cooperation of their colleagues abroad, just like in the Siemens case, there's cooperation with the prosecutors in Munich. Just in terms of getting documents, getting extradition of people if they want to prosecute individual defendants. And so there are, you know, mutual assistance treaties that are important, but also just treaties in the sense that, you know, U.S. prosecutors may want to avoid conflict with contrary foreign law. And so I mentioned treaties surrounding corruption in the bribery context. There are a lot of efforts antitrust area, cooperation agreements and the like, which have made it easier to bring those cases in cooperation with prosecutors around the world. And I mentioned this big category of ocean dumping cases. There's an international treaty about
ships and wastewater from ships, which is part of why the U.S. became so aggressive in enforcing that. So treaties have played a big role, as well as other cooperation, softer cooperation with foreign countries, and seem to really influence U.S. prosecutors in their willingness to bring these cases against foreign entities.
So I think one of the interesting things here that these cases show is that there's a kind of dialogue between domestic law and international law in these areas. And so in the FCPA context, the fact that the U.S. had criminalized extraterritorial bribery a long time ago, the U.S. was a leader in this area, and you know, this led in no small part to the feature of the corruption convention that requires parties to that convention to criminalize bribery by their corporations in other countries. So that is now, you know, whereas when the U.S. passed the statute back in 1977, it was an outlier, and it was seen, you know, in some ways as outrageous for the U.S. to criminalize the actions of not only its own companies but of other multinationals, you know, doing business in the U.S. listed on U.S. exchanges. Their actions outside the United States. Now that norm is actually required by international law. In the human rights context, you know, this dialogue has played out in a different way. You know, the U.S. Had been seen as a leader in some ways in accountability for international human rights abuses. That has been, you know, that status has been diminished somewhat by the Kiobel case. But the Alien Tort Statute was always unique. It was not unique in the sense that it allowed claims to be brought here for violations in other countries. What was unique about it, and still is, but what's always been unique about it is that it does not define the torts that can be brought. It says you can bring torts for violations of the law of nations, which is otherwise known as customary international law. And that is a feature that, as far as we know, has not been replicated in any other legal system. And so I think part of what's going on here is that courts are somewhat uncomfortable with dealing directly with international law. They're far more comfortable when Congress decides to implement international norms. So there are many countries around the world that actually allow civil suits for violations of international law, but they do it through statutes that allow, that, you know, provide penalties for torture or for crimes against humanity or war crimes or genocide, for example. And that has typically, historically, been the way that international law has been enforced. One of the major errors of the Second Circuit's decision in the Kiobel case, which determined that corporations were not subject to international law, and that the Convention on Corruption is actually a counterexample showing that corporations are very much subject to international law. But one of the grave errors there was that the court looked at the history of international prosecutions in the sense of prosecutions by international tribunals and said, well, you couldn't prosecute corporations at Nuremberg, which is debatable whether they could or couldn't, but they didn't in any case. They didn't prosecute corporations at Nuremberg. There was no jurisdiction over corporations in the Rwanda Tribunal or the Yugoslavia Tribunal, and there currently is no jurisdiction over corporations in the International Criminal Court, and therefore international law doesn't apply to corporations. What that fundamentally misses is that international law has always been primarily enforced by states. And to suggest that, you know, the limits of international tribunals circumscribe the limits of international law suggests that, number one, there wasn't any international law prohibition before Nuremberg, and that there weren't any between Nuremberg and the Yugoslavia Tribunal, which was a span of about 50 years, which is a very misguided view of international law. International law has always been primarily enforced through domestic action by states. And the FCPA is now, you know, while initially was an example of the U.S. kind of reaching out to push the limits is now an example of the U.S. enforcing international norms.
The question was whether the Monsanto controversy is something that either of the speakers have thought about or dealt with, and what are their concerns about that?
Engineering? Yeah, that's not on my radar.
It, you know, it hasn't come up directly in our work. I'm vaguely familiar with a litany of complaints against Monsanto, but we haven't worked on Monsanto directly.
So they have
not directly.
Well, if there are no more questions or comments, then let's thank both of the speakers. Thank you very much for coming. And thank all of you for coming.
Thank you so much. Sure.